This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. One on the local news roundup, fallout from HB2 continues with both the NCAA and the ACC pulling championship games from Charlotte and around the state. That may play a role in this year's gubernatorial election and the lieutenant governor's race. We look into that as well as some of the other goings-on as this battleground state leads or heads to November. Wells Fargo finds itself in a scandal. They've been fined by regulators over bogus accounts created to meet sales figures. The bank takes action, but so do regulators. Prosecutors in Charlotte and San Francisco are heading up the probe. Katz reveals its Silver Line light rail plans for Independence Boulevard, and former Charlotte Mayor Patrick Cannon gains his independence. He's released from prison to serve the rest of his sentence under house arrest, or so we think. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. We're joined by WFAE's Tom Bullock and Sean Flynn, managing editor for Time Warner Cable News here in Charlotte. Welcome back to both of you.
Good morning.
And here, dripping with printer's ink once again, our two Erics. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer at the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Let's start with the NCAA. What games is North Carolina losing as a result of HB2?
A lot, actually. I actually brought a list here to make sure that I got them correct. Division I Women's Soccer Championship, Division III Men's
That's
and Women's...
That's in Cary, soccer.
Division III Men's and Women's Soccer Championships, mm-hmm. Division I Women's Golf Regional Championships, Division III Men's and Women's Tennis Championship, Division I Women's Lacrosse Championship, and Division II Baseball Championship, along with the, I believe... Well, no, that's actually ACC. That's the list.
Okay. You left out the first and second rounds of the NCAA men's basketball.
That's what I was thinking.
Nobody cares about
that's true.
It's a little something called March Madness. You may have. I hope you didn't participate in the pool. That would be wrong. But
so most of those, most of the places that those games were going to be played were up around the state capitol.
Well, spread out actually, Greensboro, Durham, Cary, which hosted a lot of these events. So and that's actually one of the more interesting things to me about what we're seeing right now with HB2. For a long time, Republicans have kind of, I'll say, scoffed, if not outright laughed, that a lot of the economic impact has happened in essence to two areas, Charlotte and Raleigh-Durham. Mm-hmm. And frankly, they think, well, Charlotte, you know, they claim Charlotte is what started this in the first place when they passed their expanded non-discrimination ordinance. So they think, you're going to have to deal with that. Ha ha. Now you're really starting to see it spread to other areas.
And it's going to areas that don't have major league sports. We have the Panthers and we have the Hornets. They have college basketball, college sports, and the state has historically thrived on its fan base.
Yeah, I was just say, I mean, and so many people have said this, and it's absolutely true. NBA and NFL are one thing, but in North Carolina, mm-hmm. any place in the South, college sports is the very fabric.
This is
the culture. I mean, this
is where the rubber meets the road on HB2. Then,
Absolutely. This I think has a much, much broader, bigger, more powerful impact than losing the NBA All-Star game.
Look, you can tell from my accent, I am not a native North Carolinian. Right?
No, you're from Georgia.
But I'll tell you, my understanding of North Carolina as a child is based on a simple fact.
Yeah.
Who was playing in basically the March Madness Championship? I knew about, you know, the Tar Heels and the Devils and the Demon Deacons and the Wolfpack. I knew about all those long before I ever, you know, came to the state. So for those people who are actually North Carolinians, who are actually it is part, Eric, you're exactly right. It's part of their identity. I mean, if you drive around my neighborhood, which I was thinking about this morning as I was coming in, I saw a couple political signs out, but I saw a ton of flags hanging below mailboxes that show partisanship to a school, mm-hmm. right? And most of those school flags were ACC.
College football, certainly we start with college basketball, but also college football. So, and you're going to mention that with the ACC football championship as well.
Which we lost at Bank of America Stadium. Right. And ACC and football is sometimes an oxymoron. But
they're getting better.
You got to give Clemson credit and Boston College and Florida State.
But anyway, what is the psychological damage here, do you think? We always talk about the economic damage.
I think you already see it on the side of HB2 supporters who are now. I think before this, they were all just saying, "Okay, we've won. Everybody, just settle down. You know, it's you know, it's going to be okay. And now you have Franklin Graham basically, you know, screaming on Facebook saying for pastors to call, you know, call legislators and don't let them back down. I think this is sort of the tipping point has been reached, and you see Republican lawmakers now, I think two of them at least, who have said it's time to call the legislature back into session and to think about doing something.
One of them is Senator Jeff Tart from here in Mecklenburg County. Huh. And the interesting thing is these are three Republicans who two of them voted for HB2. The third was basically on an excused absence during the special session. And it's is it a huge groundswell? No, we're talking about three Republicans, and none of them are named Berger or Moore. But the reality of it is this could start to signal something that everybody, you know, that it's not just great. We're going to – everybody settle down, as you said. We've won. You're going to have to deal with it. Now people
I think the bigger issue that we're sort of circling around here is, look, the political situation has not been there, doesn't seem to be there. But when you cut into the psychological and the cultural heart of the state, maybe the public sentiment will finally drive home at some point. It might not be until after the election that – look, this has gone far enough. However we all feel about it, you've got to find some way to get college basketball, for example, back in North Carolina.
If I could add on that, I have several friends who, honestly, for the last few months, they kept asking, what's HB2? Because they're just not into it. They don't care. They don't see the ramifications of it. But when you talk about taking away their basketball, all of a sudden now they're up in arms about it. Mm-hmm. And now I think this actually really drives home the point of what HB2 is and what it is doing. And again, make great change. But I think the first change we're going to see is going to happen
in November. Yeah, to tie into Hillary's week, sometimes a cough is just a cough, and sometimes a cough is pneumonia. And I think right now we have pneumonia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's – I mean, the reality of it is, too, that I think – and this part of it I actually think is a little bit underreported. The games, the championship games that we're talking about are for this academic year, right? 2016-2017. Right. But Charlotte and other cities are already bidding for future events. And if you read closely the statements by both the ACC and the NCAA, it seems very clear to me that they're not going to hold these events in North Carolina until something changes.
Oh, so we're not talking about a year.
What else could we lose?
And let's start with 2018. March of 2018, NCAA first and second round men's basketball are still scheduled for Charlotte. But, of course, they will be struck in a matter of time if there are no changes to HB2 because we're going year by year. Then, as Tom said, we as the city are bidding for three more years of NCAAs. They would not get all 3 years. They probably get at least one, maybe two. Then you're also looking at the CIAA all of a sudden is getting a little jittery. Southern Conference. There are rumblings that the Belt Bowl, because it has an ACC school and an SEC school, might be a little jittery. We don't know. But so you have all kinds of things out there.
Well, and the Belt Bowl is interesting because I think with bowl games, they have to get a certification from the NCAA to say you can play that game there.
What about the PGA?
Well, that's probably the most interesting case out there. Now, remember when the NBA said they were taking the All-Star game, the PGA came out pointedly, PGA of America, I should say, and said, we're staying. We may think twice about coming back, but we will be here in 2017. I asked this week, does any of this change, any updated statement? And they said no. But remember, I think that the instance to point to is 1990, Shoal Creek. The PGA Championship, there was news surfaced from the club director that they would not allow African Americans into that club in Birmingham. And it sort of took off, and then it kind of cooled. And then when sponsors got jittery, all of a sudden that club went out and found an African American member in a hurry because the tournament was almost lost.
We're going to talk about sports, and it's odd, and it's kind of odd bedfellows, it seems to me, with HB2, no pun intended. But I mean, we're going to talk about that on Monday. But aside from sports activities and the occasional Stephen Schwartz show that might be passing through town, which will not be passing through North Carolina because he won't allow his shows to play here. What else might we lose? I mean, Bruce Springsteen's already canceled. He's not coming back anytime soon.
Well, I think the other things that we might lose, as has been said repeatedly throughout this, you look downtown, you've got all these big office towers coming up. I don't think it's a a coincidence that several of them are still lacking anchor tenants. I think HB2 is having a depressive effect and all this sort of hullabaloo. Why would you bring, if you're a Fortune 500 company thinking about where to relocate and you're needing to relocate right now, mm-hmm. and you can come into the middle of all this craziness, or you can just go to Atlanta or Nashville or somewhere else where, you know,
The interesting comparison with that would have to be South Carolina, which for years was known as the intolerant Carolina. I think North Carolina has now taken that mantle. But they still got Boeing and BMW and a bunch of a lot of car plants, but not major Fortune 500 company headquarters or major high-tech facilities. And that's really what we're in the market for here, at least in Charlotte. But I think the big thing that we can lose, Mike, is simple. When all of these championship games are played and televised,
they'll be talking about
about why they're not in North Carolina. And that is the intangible that's harder to put a dollar amount on. There's a pipeline when it comes to bringing businesses or sports games or whatever. It takes time.
You have to get the rotation, in essence.
Yeah, and honestly, I think the big thing that we can continue to lose, and this may surprise people who have been against HB2 from the first place, is people now will start paying attention to HB2 and North Carolina's reputation differently. As you talked about, Sean, because sports means something different. It will be a different way to bring this up with a different group of people.
But, of course, the bottom line here is always the bottom line. And Charlotte has already lost somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million because of the cancellation of the NBA All-Star Weekend and now the ACC Football Championship, which was going to be bringing about $32.5 million to the city's coffers. We attract a lot of events, and we have the Panthers and the Hornets here. These other areas of the state don't attract as many events. How will it be worse? Will it be harder on them than it will be on us?
Not in the short run, but I think in the long run, I mean, places like Charlotte and Raleigh are the economic engines that drive North Carolina's, as a state, North Carolina's, you know, economic engine is, you know, they're, right. We're the heartbeat of it. And if these cities suffer, then there's going to be a ripple effect in the rural areas.
You just entered into the debate that they have in Raleigh every year. Should we take money to the rural areas or should we leave it in the cities? What drives the economic engines? You know, everyone says as well as Charlotte and Raleigh does, the rest of the state does. And then you have some people in their rural areas who say, hey, we need the money. We need support here so we can grow just like them.
I think what Mike is pointing to is the proportionality of this, that, you know, if you go to Greenville, North Carolina, you know, one even second-tier NCAA event is comparatively much more valuable because they don't really get a whole lot else. Yeah. And so,
I think the people in Cary will say this absolutely hurts them more than it did in Charlotte. If you go specifically to your question about these events, you know, we had an interview with somebody who helps bring these sporting events to Cary, and he referred to it as, you know, the worst week, mm-hmm. an unprecedentedly bad week for them.
Well, and also the loss of the ACC football championship in Charlotte comes at a time of the year when the hotel rooms that have been booked for that game will not be replaced.
That's a great point, Mike. And so you have not only that in December. Remember the bowl game, if something happens there, that's also in December. Remember that in Greensboro, those hotel rooms in March, who's going to Greensboro in March if you're not going to see basketball?
Right. So it's good. It's a big impact. We'll talk about the political implications of that when we come back in a moment. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News, Sean Flynn from Time Warner Cable News, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, Eric Frazier from the Charlotte Observer. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Duke Energy, providing grants and employee volunteers to work with local charities and outreach organizations. More information at duke-energy.com/community. And communities and schools, investing in Charlotte's future by collaborating with corporate, faith, and community partners with the goal of helping students stay in school and achieve in life. Details at cischarlotte.com. A surprising amount of negative reaction to North Carolina's HB2 is coming from the world of sports. The NBA, of course, withdrew its All-Star game. We've been talking about this morning. NCAA pulled out. ACC followed suit. Well, the macho world of sports taking up the cause of transgender rights seems unlikely. But is it really? We look at social activism in sports on this program Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Reams Show, the Friday News Roundup, a new poll shows Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump virtually tied in the presidential race. Russian hackers leak emails from former Secretary of State Colin Powell, and the Justice Department opens an investigation into Wells Fargo over a fake accounts scandal.
The Friday News Roundup continues on the Diane Reams Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and today is the finale of our summer showcase of listener covers of our Charlotte Talks theme.
Nice that it was the blues, given what's happened here.
let's hear it again, then. Let's play it again. Go. Maybe not. for the past month, we've been playing our favorite listener entries during the roundup, including the one you just heard from John Tice. We'll hear a little longer version of John's cover a little bit later on in the program. What has the fallout been among fans, alumni, university people, students, etc.? Have we heard anything from them about the loss of these NCAA and ACC games?
I think the dust is still settling on that one. I don't think we can really answer it yet. We've heard from presidents. We've heard from leagues. I think it's going to take a little bit of time for people to kind of figure out. And honestly, especially when it comes to diehard fans, you know, there are basically two moments where I think their ire about this, or lack of ire about this, will be known: November and when the games were supposed to be played. But I think until that point, we're still...
I also think it depends on where the championships end up.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's a good point.
If you're Clemson and all of a sudden you're going down to Orlando instead of Charlotte for the championship game, and you're playing Florida State.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you're pissed.
All of a sudden you are very upset. Right.
Yeah. That's a great point, Sean.
Yeah.
The NBA acted early in the situation. The NCAA finally decided what they wanted to do, and then following that, the ACC put both feet into the pond.
You know, it was sort of a Dean Smith four corners when it came to the ACC decision on what to do.
Are they doing this reluctantly because they have to, because everybody else is doing it?
I think it's easier when the big dogs have already moved. Yeah. I think the NBA is one thing, but the NCAA, when you're the ACC, that means it's a huge.
Then you can.
The ACC Council of Presidents reaffirmed the collective commitment to uphold. This is a quote: to uphold the values of equality, diversity, inclusion, and non-discrimination. HB2 was inconsistent with those values. If that's true, it was inconsistent. A year ago.
Yeah, why did it take 6 months to figure that out? I think because of the reason Tom just said. You sort of avoid a lot of heat and pressure by letting the NCAA go first. And the other thing we should mention is the ACC is headquartered in North Carolina. It's headquartered in Greensboro. It's a lot harder for a Greensboro-based organization to sort of thumb its nose at state government than for the NCAA.
Yeah. And in fairness, too, let's face it, the NCAA sent a letter to lawmakers earlier this year saying, we've got some problems with this. We're going to look at what
none of this is a surprise.
Totally out of the blue.
Yeah. No, none of this is a surprise. And I think to sort of flip the script a little bit, even the NBA for months said, we have concerns, something has to change, and nothing changed. And so these events have gone away. It can't be shocking.
North Carolina House Speaker Tim Moore, in reacting to the losses of these games, said the loss is very unfortunate, but that, and we quote, the truth remains that this law was never about and does not promote discrimination. Can that be true on any level?
Sure. I mean, the answer is simple. It's all about perceptions. And I'm sure I noticed the silence when I said hear me out. Hear me out.
Right.
Hear me out. I'm not saying the perception is correct. I'm saying that is the perception of a certain group of people who have their views on this law. I noticed the silence when I said sure. But reality is
it's not just about the bathrooms. It's about the fact that they remove the ability of local municipalities to pass anti-discrimination ordinances that exceed the power of the states of anti-discrimination.
I absolutely agree. And I know that's absolutely right.
But remember the counter argument. I'm sorry, Tom, let me interrupt for just a second. The counter argument on that one piece is that in North Carolina, the state is the ultimate arbiter, that the city should not be able to supersede state regulation.
Look at it this way. There are some people who truly believe that this law is, as its title implies, it's about protection. Protection of women and children in restrooms. Now, if you doubt that, go talk to a supporter of House Bill 2. I'm not saying their view is correct. Mm-hmm. I think we've all ripped this bill to shreds in numerous ways. But the reality is, yes, there are some people that see this bill as not discriminatory and they are being attacked. Now, what they do not address in those statements is the fact that it has always been illegal in North Carolina to go into a restroom, become a sexual predator, expose yourself in some other way. There was a great question asked in Lieutenant Governor's debate this week where the Lieutenant Governor was asked that specific question. If all of these things were always there, mm-hmm. then why was this bill necessary? And he didn't really answer that question. And that is the question I would say to supporters of the bill to ask yourself.
UNC President Margaret Spellings, who is not known to be a liberal, issued a statement saying that the university appreciates that the ACC shares the university's commitment to creating an inclusive atmosphere for all, but she regretted that the decision will penalize affected host communities, she said. She also brought up a difficult point. Her statement reads, "As we have said many times, UNC institutions do not discriminate on the basis of sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity and remain caught in the middle." Charlotte, which started all of this with the city council vote, has also been penalized for taking for actions being taken against its will by the legislature. So why is Charlotte? Why are the universities being penalized? Why are these organizations penalizing cities and organizations that had nothing to do with
it? Well, I think because if you want to make a statement, this is really the only way to make a statement that resonates. It's the only thing that sort of cuts through the typical clutter of political debate. As Sean said, you know, sports and entertainment, something like Springsteen not coming here or the NCAA March Madness pulling out, people notice that. You know, an arcane debate about whether we're a home rule state or a Dillon state, most people just don't care.
It's also the tool they have. Yeah. There aren't a huge amount of other things they can do. Realistically, they're really
not. But I will say that, you know, that where Governor McCrory and others who support HB2 have a really powerful argument, I think, is when they talk about the Final Four in Houston. Houston shredded its own ordinance that protected gay and transgender rights and then staged the Final Four in April, and nobody said word. There are differences.
The key difference being that voters
There are differences.
I think when you look back at what North Carolina did with what was that the same sex marriage
Amendment one.
That was voters, and that went through, and you didn't see what we've seen in the wake of HB 2. So I think for people who are activists and are passionate about equality and equal rights, they're willing to let individual citizens have their viewpoint on it. But when a government agency or a legislature tries to legislate discrimination, they're gonna fight back.
Particularly the way this one was done.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about the economic loss of $100 million just for Charlotte because of the NBA and the ACC decisions, that trickles down. That is not just the Westin Hotel and the people who own the Westin Hotel losing $100 million. That's the waiters and waitresses and the people who make up the beds and the bellhops and the people who run the parking garages. They're all losing a lot of money. So Nathan on Twitter asks a very interesting question. Can the city sue the state over the loss of revenue?
No.
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 Can the Westin? Can the Marriott?
I don't know the answer to, but I can answer specifically to the city because actually Eric brought it up when he was talking about the arcane arguments between whether or not we're a home rule or a Dillon rule state. For the record, we're a Dillon rule state, which basically means – I love the fact that stales into that.
And the times they aren't a change.
Yeah, yes, exactly. what it boils down to is we are – the city of Charlotte and county of Mecklenburg and every other subdivision of government in the state of North Carolina is – nothing but a smaller branch of the state government. They control all. They have all the power. Now the Westin and all that. That's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to.
Well, I was going to say, Mike, the thing that struck me about when you started is both sides sort of get into full high dudgeon mode when they talk about the ticket takers and the people who are affected. I mean, Governor McCrory went into that yesterday when he was in Charlotte. He said, you know, it's just amazing that anyone would think of taking these jobs from people who really need the work. And on the other side, HB2 opponents are saying the same thing.
The governor was here. He was speaking at a Hood-Hargett meeting. It looked like it was at the Palm.
Mm-hmm. It was.
From the picture in the newspaper. And according to The Observer, he said he'd never stopped working on compromise efforts. We talked about this morning. You did in a piece that you did, mm-hmm. Tom. Never stopped working on compromise efforts. And he blasted Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts for violating a planned compromise. What's he referring to there?
That actually happened in May. And it was a really fascinating meeting of the city council. What basically happened is we heard tell that there may be a compromise in the works. Everybody swarms Jennifer Roberts when she was walking up to the dinner meeting. She says there's no compromise. It looked like it was scuttled at some point. And then all of a sudden, you sit through the meeting, and it was a long meeting. At the very end, council member Kenny Smith, who's a Republican, brought up the motion for a compromise. And we don't know really the full details to this day of that compromise. I talked with Kenny afterwards, and I couldn't get any details from him because there was still hope in his mind that some kind of a compromise would be reached. And originally, it looked like the city council had votes for whatever this compromise was. But it looks like two votes in particular, James Mitchell and Vi Lyles, changed back to the no compromise block, and it was voted down by the city council.
But he blamed the mayor. Is it mayor's fault?
But he blamed mayor and council, and part of what Tom's talking about is there were a lot of discussions going on in terms of compromise between Republicans and Democrats that the city would repeal the ordinance that had already been negated,
yeah.
but
mm-hmm.
take it off the books. And then that led to pressure from the Human Rights Campaign and Equality NC, which Governor McCrory, yeah. among others, is always citing as a huge impediment to compromise. And so that
more
is,
powerful than the NRA.
Right.
Yes. Which, for the record, is a ridiculous statement.
But that is believed, that pressure is believed to have flipped some votes, perhaps, and prevented a compromise. Of course, everything was moving in multiple directions. So,
yeah.
Well, what all this raises is the question of, are we back at that same spot in time where there's a need for a compromise? They had one sort of, kind of, almost worked out. And I think the argument from the HRC folks was that city council should not take action unilaterally without knowing what Phil Berger and the boys
That's
in Raleigh
exactly
would
right.
do.
The fear was, what if we take this step as the city council?
And they change
council?
A consonant from a lowercase to an uppercase in the bill. Yeah.
Right.
So you were there yesterday, Tom, at the Hood-Hargett meeting that the governor spoke at. Here's something else he had to say.
It's not going to be resolved by North Carolina legislature. It's not going to be resolved by the city of Charlotte. It's not going to be resolved by the ACC or the NCEA, who meets in private behind closed doors with no transcripts of what they've done. Unelected people. It's going to be decided by the Supreme Court, and it deserves a Supreme Court hearing because it's a very, very complex issue.
And obviously he's talking about any changes to House Bill 2. When he said that, there are two things – and Eric, you were there too, so I'd love to hear what you have to say about that. But there are two things that stuck out immediately to me. The first is where he's criticizing the NCAA and the ACC for making these decisions behind closed doors and without a transcript. Which is an ironic statement when it comes to House Bill 2, which was passed in 12 hours, was not open to public reading until immediately when that session began, and nobody has transcripts or any kind of understanding of who put what in the bill, and it's impossible to this day to figure out who built that bill and each segment of that bill. The other thing that's interesting, though, is he actually started, to me at least, to start shifting his tone a bit. Now, he's pretty angry there. But when he gets to the Supreme Court, his tone is very different than it has been in the past. In the past with the NBA, boy, did he love to blast their hypocrisy, the sports elites, the business elites. Of course, they're the same people that he not only lobbied to come to Charlotte in the first place, and actually the state and the city paid a lot of money to try to get those games here. He didn't do that now. His tone is now more – to me, it sounded a bit more conciliatory, and he – you know, it doesn't mean he's ready to jump and start arguing for changes for the bill, but it's clear that the hypocrisy arguments aren't working.
I would say he was Jekyll and Hyde, because earlier he was talking about the political and cultural and corporate elite and how they were trying to bully North Carolina, and then in the next breath he says what you just mentioned. But the point that jumped out to me in that sequence is that he made several references to the Supreme Court fixing this.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go back and look. The NBA and the NCAA in particular have cited a number of problems they have with House Bill 2 beyond the bathroom issue. True. And so that is a big, big stumbling block. Or it's just misleading.
It's a bit of a cop-out.
You can't say that that would fix it, because let's assume the Supreme Court made gender identity the rule of the law, the law of the land, if I can even speak. You still have the other problems in HB2 that would not bring these events back.
And that falls right back in his lap, in the legislature's lap, in the city council's lap. They have to somehow get together and figure this thing out. It's not going away.
There are some people who would say this is going to hurt the governor in the election, and maybe it is, and we can talk about that, but maybe it's not, because there are going to be a significant number of people who absolutely agree with him and with Phil Berger and other supporters of HB2, and they are just as likely to dig in their heels as the politicians are and support the governor in his reelection campaign because he's supporting them. Is that not true?
Absolutely.
I
think that's what's fascinating about this election. It's really hard to tell what's going to happen because of that. And the other thing that I think about, going back to what Sean said earlier, is sports cuts through so many things. So now do you have some people who are suddenly motivated to vote who are not politically immersed, and they go to the polls? And if so, which side are they with?
Yeah, you've now got like a head of, what is it, Red Ventures, that company in Fort Mill, giving employees paid time off to go and vote because of HB2.
And the CEO is a former huge McCrory supporter who has gone against him now because of this bill.
Yeah.
Look, a close friend of John Calipari, who coaches the Kentucky Wildcats. Yes, so he's probably a little aggravated with this whole nonsense.
John on Twitter asks, what evidence does our governor have when he says that organizations are using HB2 to get out of bad business decisions?
I haven't heard that.
I had not heard that one either. Right. I had not heard it.
This argument has come to the lieutenant governor's race, because this week they had a little debate or a forum between Dan Forrest, the lieutenant governor, and his Democratic opponent, Linda Coleman. They sparred over the bill. They vehemently, obviously, disagreed with each other. What was the crux of the arguments each made?
Well, you know, first of all, when it comes to Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, for those people who don't know, he is arguably the most vocal, vehement supporter of House Bill 2 that there is, even more than Tim Moore or Phil Berger.
Yeah, I would argue when something comes out, his news releases are out within a few minutes.
Yeah, and he helped call the special session as president pro tem of the Senate. I mean, he and Tim Moore arranged for the special session because McCrory wouldn't call it. His argument, and it's fascinating to me, because there's still, to this day, as much as we've all talked about House Bill 2, there's so much misinformation that's out there. His argument was that Charlotte is home to, because of this ordinance that the Republicans say kicked this whole thing off, Charlotte is trying to take part in this huge social experiment. Mm-hmm. And he said that the city ordinance actually demanded that the bathroom signs be taken down on all restrooms, which is just blatantly false. But he basically says, you know, HB2 is great. Coleman says, no, it needs to be repealed.
When we come back, electioneering in North Carolina and Wells Fargo, among other things. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Goodwill Industries of the Southern Piedmont, dedicated to breaking barriers to employment, training job seekers, and offering health care and banking at the Goodwill Opportunity Campus. Information at goodwillsp.org. And Elon University, committed to redefining higher education with more that matters, including those collaborations between students, faculty, and staff mentors. Details at elon.edu. A new poll shows Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump virtually tied in the presidential race. Russian hackers leak emails from former Secretary of State Colin Powell, and the Justice Department opens an investigation into Wells Fargo over fake accounts. We'll be talking about those. Actually, we won't, but the Diane Reed Show will be talking about that coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock as the weekly news roundup continues. You can join our roundup by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter @CharlotteTalks. What happens when you cut the cable cord for the summertime?
There were only a few moments where I felt like a little behind on the, like, water cooler conversation.
Color me surprised. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Cord cutting done on the cheap. That is next time on Marketplace.
Cut it!
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
Prithee. Continue listening, if you will. The Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup continues on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's one of the last entries in our summer showcase of listener covers from a group well-known in this area, actually, called Carolina Pro Musica. They're made up of Gordon Edward Farrell and Karen Jacob, whose husband I used to work with at WBTV. He worked in Master Control, John. We thank everybody who's taken the time over the past month to come up with a cover. We weren't able to play them all, and there's some that I really do want to play, particularly the one with lyrics. But we appreciate your participation. And I also appreciate the help of Sarah D'Elia from WFAE News and Chris Miller, one of our producers, for working very hard to make this happen and to get these cuts on the air. Thanks to both of them. Okay, electioneering in North Carolina. The vice president was here this week to speak at CPCC, and he didn't utter the magic words Hillary Clinton. He only spoke about community colleges. Is that right?
Yeah, community colleges.
What's
and job
up with that?
It's easy. I mean, let's face it. Hillary Clinton is proudly running on a continuation of Obama policies. For the most part, there are some significant areas where she differs with the president. But, you know, in essence, having Joe Biden come down here to talk about something that Democrats see as proof the economy is working is a de facto stop by a surrogate.
Okay. Without having to pay for it.
Without having to pay for it, absolutely.
Hillary took some time off because of her pneumonia diagnosis to recuperate this week, but one of her first stops upon resuming the campaign was in Greensboro yesterday. Last week she was in Charlotte at Johnson C. Smith University. Who did she speak to in Greensboro? What did she say?
Well, the first thing she did is come out to "I Feel Good."
Yeah, that's right.
Which exactly? I actually pulled a Hillary Clinton myself and have walking pneumonia, so I feel for her. I have that relationship with Hillary Clinton.
You have it right now.
Yeah, well, I'm not contagious anymore.
and now Mike Collins reaches for Purell.
And we're not sharing the same microphone, so we're okay.
I feel your pain.
But no, her message was it was about – there I go, coughing.
A cough.
I'm sorry, I can't
talk. A cough is the telltale sign.
Coughs, another coughs or pneumonia.
Well, living in Stephen King's The Stand right now. Go ahead.
Somebody help him to his car, please.
I'm apparently one of those people she was talking about who can't afford to take that day off for health care. She used her sickness to talk about health care and other issues that are important to her and, most importantly, get out there and show that she was strong and her voice was strong, as I'm not. And most importantly, the one thing that I noticed is that in all of her visits here the last couple months, she's always 45 minutes late, not longer.
Democrats are always late.
She was on time yesterday.
Really?
The stagecraft for that had to have been just micromanaged down to the last millimeter.
While she was here, she was critical of HB2. She said she was running for president for the LGBT teenager, and she went on to say that this is where bigotry leads, and we can't afford it.
It really points out the fact that she came here and talked about that as her first, rise up from her deathbed appearance. It says a lot. And even when she was still at home, she was tweeting about HB2. Yeah. It tells you a lot about how potent the Democratic Party thinks this issue is.
It also tells you how potent and key North Carolina is for Donald Trump. And the reality of it is, this was her first stop after the pneumonia hiatus. Mm-hmm. And
the pneumonia hiatus, that's an alt-rock band.
Totally. It really just boils down to, it's almost impossible to see how Donald Trump can get to the White House without a victory in North Carolina. It's possible, but it's incredibly difficult. And over this time, over the last couple of weeks, Hillary Clinton has been just tripping over herself and her campaign with the basket of deplorables, the near collapse at the 9/11 commemoration, then finally coming out with the pneumonia thing. And her poll numbers have really,
dropped. But in North Carolina, they're stable.
They're stable, but they're still within the margin of error, which says
– But when you compare what they've been doing nationally to what happens here, it's just interesting that she's more stable here than other places.
But
I'm not sure what to make of it, but it's interesting.
You're absolutely right. The Real Clear Politics, for those who don't read this stuff regularly the Real Clear Politics poll of polls has her up by 0.6 points. Now, to say that's within the margin of error is an understatement. But I think that what Eric's saying, just real quick, I'm sorry, Mike.
Yeah.
What he's saying is right, because if she's staying steady here and if this is a key state to stop a Trump presidency, by continuing to focus on HB2, she gets in the headlines. By coming here so regularly, she stays on voters' minds. It is a real potential strength, and I expect to see it often.
Trump has eclipsed her. We shouldn't be talking about national politics because that's going to be hot next hour, but Trump eclipses her right now in Florida. I think he eclipses her in Ohio. Pennsylvania is on the fence. It's incredibly close here, and he was here in Asheville.
And he'll be here twice more next week. I think two events on Tuesday.
And Chelsea was here. So this is an important set, obviously. Meanwhile, George W. Bush, who was glaringly absent from recent Republican conventions, is scheduled to headline a Charlotte fundraiser for Republican U.S. Senator Richard Burr on October the 11th. Has any national Democratic Party figure or the national party itself done anything to support Deborah Ross?
Well, Hillary Clinton was here with fundraisers, and you know that some of that big money, because all of the ticket prices would far exceed the federal limit for an individual contributor. These are bundled events, which means people can give money to an individual candidate, but also to these election committees, these fundraising tag teams. And so that's where Deborah Ross has gotten some money. So, yes.
Okay. Let's move on to Wells Fargo. They were fined by regulators for bogus accounts created by what the bank calls rogue employees. Employees who were later fired and set up these accounts without customers' knowledge in order to meet sales goals. Those employees, as I said, have been fired. How badly were customers harmed? Have they been made whole by the bank? Are most customers who were affected by this aware that they were affected by
it? I find the word rogue interesting. You have 5,000 rogue employees.
Yeah.
It's like a rogue
division. It's a lot of rogues.
That's a rogue division, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And somebody higher up there obviously was pushing the incentives. And that's what it is. A lot of these companies, a lot of banking companies, the incentives is what drives people to do better. If you don't have the incentives, you end up with, I don't know, the DMV. Where you don't get great customer service.
So I was waiting for Mike to say cable, but he didn't do it. He did do it.
No. You just did it, Eric.
Right. I don't have to do it. Somebody else.
That's the old political trick where you throw it on somebody else.
And it's already do it.
But John Stumpf, who is the CEO of Wells Fargo, has said there was no incentive to do bad things.
I just don't buy that.
Employees would counter that by saying, I have to get paid.
Yeah, and they have countered it. We've already had former employees come out. I mean, one of the phrases that you hear is eight is great. That was a company mantra to sell eight products to each customer. They were setting up phantom email accounts, online accounts, I should say, so that they could hit bonus
numbers. Surely they knew they would be caught. Surely they knew this would collapse.
No, apparently they didn't know that.
Because it's been going on for a
while. 5 years at least, I think.
And remember what was going on with the mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, I think the one thing we can probably safely say is that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and Dodd-Frank and some of those things, people who support that probably have a little stronger argument.
Well, that debate is still going on in
Congress. Oh, absolutely it is.
So how will this impact that? Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, who I think is on the banking committee,
says
that Mr. Stumpf and others should be held accountable.
He'll be there next week. He's going to testify before Congress about all this and says that he's really excited to be able to explain how this is a bunch of rogue employees. But here's the thing. For people who don't follow this stuff, you know, Wells Fargo was kind of heralded as this white knight to ride in and buy failing Wachovia during the bottom of the crisis.
Right.
But they themselves were up to some really shenanigan-like things. We talked about the mortgages. Most people can't wrap their brains around exactly how the mortgages went. But the boil down for this is, you know, Wells Fargo was one of the banks that was really doing predatory lending. This is different. This is easier for people to kind of wrap their brains around because, let's face it, these 5,000 employees, they did this under Wells Fargo's, you know, they did this as members of Wells Fargo. If they weren't members of the bank where this was happening, you know what we would be calling this? We'd be calling this identity theft, because you're actually adding things onto people's accounts that they're not authorized to do. This is not a minor thing. I think the fact the company got away with $185 million fine, which is a record.
Well, it's not over yet, because prosecutors in San Francisco and Charlotte are looking into this.
But let's remember this. Wells Fargo made $23 billion last
year. That's
nothing.
$185 million.
And so here is where people get upset again, is not only is it a drop of a drop in the bucket, but you also have, to date, no high-level employees who are being censured.
In fact, there is some attempt to claw back compensation for a person who left the bank as a result of this.
Who was in charge of the retail banking.
But will it happen is the question. I mean, that's all we've heard so far is will that be employed, not that it's going to happen.
It just all points up the disconnect between what legislators in Washington think and are doing on these subjects and what people on the ground on Main Street want, because you've got the Senate banking panel just this week passed a bill that would roll back a lot of these Dodd-Frank protections.
Right. What sense is that?
If you believe some of the behind-the-scenes reporting about what happened with the banks during the financial crisis, Ken Lewis was strong-armed by the federal government into buying, was it Countrywide?
Yes.
And he didn't really want to buy it. Or Merrill Lynch, one of the two, he didn't really want to do it after he saw the details of the deal. But they said, you'll do it or we will remove you as CEO. Could they remove John Stumpf?
I don't think that's possible right now. Those were sort of the extraordinary circumstances around the financial meltdown.
I think that, you know, what could happen is if he had some sort of disastrous testimony, then, you know, maybe that could lead to pressure in the board. I think that's highly, highly unlikely based on the history we've seen with all these companies.
Right.
Well, here's something everybody's excited about. Katz unveiled its plan for light rail down Independence Boulevard this week.
I was waiting for you to say Cats, the musical.
I kept hearing Jellicle Cats. Jellicle Cats.
So they have no funding for this so-called silver line. It's estimated to cost $1 billion.
That's optimistic.
They don't even know yet how it would get into uptown from Independence Boulevard. They haven't figured that out yet. So why did they decide to reveal the plan for the route if they have no money and no way to get it down there?
They're hoping to get people excited about it and build a grassroots groundswell of support for it.
And, you know, especially with these transit projects, it's all incremental gains. I mean, they talk about design, pre-design, engineering, pre-engineering. It takes forever. And this is part of a larger plan by the new Katz CEO. He wants to ambitiously and aggressively go after a new funding mechanism, and maybe some of the excitement around this light rail line will help with that.
Well,
has he identified the new funding mechanism? Excuse me?
Has he identified the new funding mechanism?
No, they have not.
Well, with all the championship games leaving, there goes that sales tax revenue.
County Commission this week got a look at plans for the redevelopment of the North Tryon Corridor, something that we talked about on this program a year ago, it seems like to me. What will this plan entail, and why did it take so long for County Commission to get a look at it?
Well, for the same reasons that Eric Spanberg just brought up, these things take a lot of time, and it's a pretty ambitious plan, actually. I mean, it's everybody here's mixed use, you know, residential, commercial, office space, all that kind of stuff. But it is really interesting, and if you look at it, I would compare it to really the expansion in South Charlotte just happening north now. That's kind of the level that they're looking at. It's, you know, yes, it's got all the mixed use stuff. It has, they say it's going to have more parks. I think the term they use is
pocket parks.
Yes.
But it's, you know, it really is trying to turn that corridor into a northern version of South Charlotte. Is that a fair way to say it, Eric?
Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, an ongoing effort to make the city more walkable, more dense. And I mean that in terms of construction, not our IQs. And I think a lot of it will probably end up happening because it's a trend nationally. All cities are trying to do this, and we certainly are no different. different.
I'd like to point out it is a vision plan. It's just a vision. Right. It really is up to the developers. And honestly, the Levines own 23 acres of land in that First Ward area. They're the ones who are going to basically determine what's put there. But I remember talking to Daniel Levine last year, and he says he wants that 18 by 7 walkable community with all these parks.
What does that mean, 18 by 7? 18 feet by 7 feet? What does that mean?
It's a micro community.
At 4 o'clock in the morning, he doesn't want people walking around.
Okay. All right. Patrick Cannon, the Charlotte mayor who was convicted of corruption while in office, returned home to house arrest yesterday. Is that where he's going, or is he going to a halfway house, or do we know?
We don't know for sure. We are on Cannon watch, and he somehow snuck out of the prison, and we haven't seen him at home yet.
Okay, so, now you make it sound like he escaped. He
was Shawshank Redemption.
So he will be on this house arrest until January, and then he's on probation for a couple of years. Was this what was expected when he was sentenced originally?
Yes. Good time off for good behavior, plus he entered a treatment program, which if you do voluntarily, cut some more time off your actual behind bars prison sentence. Cannon said he was an alcoholic and went through treatment.
Okay. The Panthers are 0-1 on the season. They play San Francisco here at home, their opening game on Sunday. Every sports poll that I've looked at has the Panthers winning this. Any predictions?
I agree with that. I do think they will win. San Francisco is not a particularly strong team, although they look strong because they played the ailing Rams last week. But Mike, we have to get through the national anthem and see how Colin Kaepernick's kneeling
will
affects
he stand,
the
kneel?
Populace.
Yeah.
Governor McCrory even took time out to address that yesterday. He said he was offended that he was not being – that the politics were entering sports. Go ahead, Sean.
I was just going to say, and the flyover that happens Sunday is authorized, unlike like the one a couple weeks ago. I love the Panthers tweeting that out. We'll be ready.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's Local News
Roundup,
as well as our summer showcase of Charlotte Talks themes covers, which now close with more from John Tice. Thanks again to everybody who participated in that showcase. And thank you all as well.